This week on the Best of Flashpoints, a frustrated Iraqi journalist chucks his shoes at George W. Bush and becomes an instant hero across the Arab world. We'll hear from Iraqi blogger and human rights activist Riyad Jarrar. Catherine Austin Fitz joins us for another edition of Community Business. The Block Report features an interview with the son of Stan Tookie Williams on the third anniversary of his state-sponsored murder. And the Knight Report. Dennis Bernstein, JR, and Robert Knight are coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Stay tuned because straight ahead after the Knight Report, we'll be speaking with Catherine Austin Fitz, and it is going to be interesting. But now, from exile in New York City, the Knight Report with Robert Knight.
In today's Knight Report, a second look at the SOFA Treaty in Iraq. I'm Robert Knight, reporting live in New York. Despite a cathartic global reaction to the widely celebrated showdown during President Bush's clandestine visits to Iraq and Afghanistan, the significance of that visit remains obscured in much of the mainstream coverage of Bush's travels. During his Green Zone sojourn, Bush nailed down the U.S. written status of forces agreement that ostensibly legitimates at least three more years of a formal U.S. military occupation inside Iraq and leaves ambiguous the implementation of whether Iraq will have genuine legal jurisdiction and sovereignty over American troops and their contractees. Those issues are left to committees which have yet to be defined and precisely outline the terms of Iraqi authority. The SOFA technically specifies that only so-called combat troops would evacuate Iraq cities by next summer, and that more than 50 Iraqi bases as of the year 2012. But even American military commanders and high Iraqi officials have already acknowledged the U.S. occupation could actually drag on for yet another decade or more. Earlier this week, U.S. Iraqi Commander General Raymond Odierno explicitly declared that, quote, "We believe we should still be inside Iraqi cities after the summer," end quote, adding that, quote, "It's important that we maintain enough presence here that we can help them get through this year of transition," end quote. Iraqi occupation regime spokesperson Ali al-Dabbagh echoed Odierno's long-term vision of U.S. occupation this week in Washington when he said that Iraq will need at least 10 more years of American troops to provide Iraqi security. Together, the two statements indicate that the terms of the SOFA that Bush praised this week are likely to eventually be altered so that the 150,000 American troops remaining in Iraq would merely be relabeled as trainers or military security advisors, just like the American troop buildup in Vietnam was sold to the American public. Moreover, Bush praised the SOFA as a legal replacement for the United Nations mandate that expires on December 31st. However, it violates at least a dozen articles of the U.S.-imposed Iraqi Constitution. And here in the United States, members of Congress were not given a faithful version of the final treaty terms, nor did the U.S. Senate exercise its prerogative of advice and consent to vote the SOFA up or down as one of the foreign treaties over which the Senate has constitutional jurisdiction. Thus, despite the announced withdrawal of troops from the United Kingdom, Australia, Ukraine, Romania, Estonia, and El Salvador over the coming weeks and months, the overriding fact remains that as of next year, the U.S. will be the sole military force occupying Iraq with as many as 150,000 troops soon to be remarketed as technical advisors. Nevertheless, throughout the Arab and Muslim world, celebrations and demonstrations continued on behalf of the imprisoned and tortured shoe-throwing journalist Muqtadir al-Zaidi, recalling the invasions and occupations and partitions of Iraq that have killed 2 million and displaced 5 million more over the past 20 years, from the initial invasion of George Herbert Walker Bush and the current occupation of George Walker Bush, leading many critics to say that in Iraq, these walkers are made for booting. From exile in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. It has been another shaky day on Wall Street as Goldman Sachs takes a dive and the Federal Reserve lowers their interest rate to about zero, allowing investment banks to borrow free money. Meanwhile, the Bloomberg News Syndicate is suing the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System in federal court to obtain information and government records regarding the Fed's lending of public money to private financial institutions. Joining us, as always, every Wednesday is Catherine Austin Fitz with Community Business. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, Dennis.
Good to have you back. Keep your shoes on now.
What a week.
Here we go. I have in my hot little hands, and I really want to start this way, compliments of you, I might add, the actual lawsuit between Bloomberg suing in federal court, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System.
Yep.
Describe this lawsuit. What are they trying to do here?
What happened was one of the reporters, Mark Pittman at Bloomberg, attempted to understand what collateral the Fed was accepting for $2 trillion of loans. And when he couldn't get that from public information, he filed a FOIA, and the Fed was not responsive, and so Bloomberg brought a lawsuit. And what they're trying to do is demand that the Fed report on what collateral they're accepting for $2 trillion of loans. And the Fed is saying, no, you know, we're not going to tell you what it is.
Now,
that's the subject of the lawsuit.
This is amazing. I mean, we've been talking about this. They've been given, you know, probably $1 trillion by now. There is $1 trillion to give out. This is taxpayer money coming out of the Federal Reserve.
Well, actually, it's not, you know, it depends on how you debate it, because the Fed member banks are owned by private banks. And the governors of the Federal Reserve are appointed by the president. So you've got a hybrid organization, but it would be perfectly plausible if the Fed wanted to argue we're a private bank, and so these are private resources, and we don't need to disclose this because we're private. I don't know that the Fed will take that argument because, you know, they get a lot of air cover pretending that they're federal when in fact they're not a governmental entity. So, but there's no doubt about it that these are far. I would not see these as entirely private resources, and yet for the Fed to not disclose what collateral they're taking is really an admission that a lot of the collateral and securities fraud that I've described before on community business is really happening, as well as the derivative problem. Because I think the Fed literally cannot afford for the markets and the system to see what they're doing, because if people could see what they're really doing, they'd start to realize how bad it was.
Now, how bad it was, see what they're doing. There's a lot of concern in Congress about the auto bailout, but there's zero, there seems to be little concern in Congress about where all this money is going. Can we?
Quite amazing.
Can we speculate? Do we have any idea what the hell is going on?
My guess is, one, the Fed is helping people manage their derivative positions. So a lot of this money is going to shore up derivative positions, or to basically fill up the black hole created by the derivatives position. So I think you have New York Fed member banks who've been acting as agents for the Exchange Stabilization Fund and the Fed as manager of the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a treasury fund, and they've been manipulating the markets, the gold market, the stock market, using derivatives, and so they're now short on different derivative positions, and I think that's one. The second thing is, I think that there's very significant fraud, collateral fraud and securities fraud in the treasuries market and in the mortgage-backed securities market, including mortgage-backed securities, which are guaranteed by agencies of the U.S. as well as what used to be called government-sponsored enterprises, but are now essentially agencies, Freddie Fannie. So I think the fraud has been far greater. You know, the spin is that we have a whole bunch of subprime mortgages and people aren't making money and the mortgages are going down in value. And, you know, but I think it is, you know, frankly, what we're dealing with are securities where there are mortgages for which there are no homes.
Now, this financial problem that we're talking about now, as you said just earlier in this conversation, has a lot to do with perhaps a major, can we call it a criminal conspiracy? Can we call, I mean, the Fed is now, if they're paying back or bailing out these investment banks and these corporations that are involved in such risky operations that it can't even be revealed what the bailout is. I mean, it has to take us into that dark area of criminality.
Well, it takes you into the dark area of criminality, and it takes you into the dark area of the black budget, which is we know that for years financial fraud has been used to provide hundreds of billions of dollars a year to the black budget. And the question is, where is all this money going? I mean, where is all this money going?
Well, it's not going to people who are losing their houses in this foreclosure mania. That's for sure, right?
Well, there have been hypotheses over the last 5-10 years by legitimate reporters I've worked with who've tried to figure out where all this money is going. You know, that some of it is going for legitimate purposes, you know, to plug state deficits and, you know, other things, and that the internal controls have broken down so much that they have to do this kind of fraudulent business to get the money for just basic stuff. So, you know, so I think there's a wide variety of where the money's going, but we're talking about, because of the derivative manipulation and the collateral fraud in the mortgage market and the kind of fraud I suspect is in the securities market, because the way you steal, we know that $4 trillion is missing from the federal government between fiscal 1998 and fiscal 2002. The way you steal $4 trillion, Dennis, is with securities fraud. And the reports, you know, the informal reports from a variety of people indicating that the amount of government and government agent securities that are truly outstanding compared to what's on the books, you know, there's a lot of innuendo to indicate that that's a subject that requires serious investigation. So I think the Fed is keeping the wraps under where that money's going because they literally cannot afford for the market to know.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is our weekly segment, Community Business, with Catherine Austin Fitz. She is a former high-level Wall Street banker, a partner in Dillon and Reed. She was a high-level official in the first Bush administration and knows a great deal about finances. And we're talking about what the Bloomberg lawsuit against the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. Let me read number 4 in the introduction, because we have a major responsibility, and Bloomberg is actually picking it up. Here's what they're saying in 4 of the introduction. To discharge its obligation as the eyes and ears of the public, Bloomberg sought access to this information under FOIA. To date, the Fed has failed to produce the requested documents or even formally to respond to Bloomberg's request. Consequently, Bloomberg brings this suit to compel the Fed to discharge its obligations under FOIA, so that the public can be informed of how the Fed is safeguarding the public's money. This is the press's job, isn't it?
Yes.
They're trying to do it.
Yes, they are. And what's interesting is some of the best financial reporting over the last year of the bailouts and the sort of what's been going on in the financial markets has come from Bloomberg. Very hard-hitting, very detailed stuff, and the fact that they're now bringing a lawsuit is quite extraordinary.
Well, I want to let people know that you have this up on your website at Solari.com, and they might want to download and make it available to their local news people. One of the things, as soon as I got it, I walked over to our news department here and made sure that our news person, John Hamilton, had it in his hands. And I hope that we can, this is kind of the kind of stuff that we can do as an alternative media to make sure there's a bubble up, to force this kind of information out. Well, We're going to obviously follow this lawsuit down the line, but let's talk a little bit about Goldman Sachs. They took a dive today. That's unusual.
Yeah, they're expected to post a loss of approximately $2 billion, same with Morgan Stanley. And that's unusual, Dennis, because these are institutions that have always seemed to, you know, whatever, when if things are moving up, they're going up. If they're moving down, they're making money on that, too. So these are institutions that have been unbelievably savvy at doing well, you know, no matter what part of the cycle they're in.
All right. And, I mean, Goldman Sachs has been providing the brain trust for various administrations for quite a while, and that hasn't changed under Obama, has it?
Goldman Sachs was one of the largest contributors to both Obama and Clinton in the campaign, and is very politically active, and they're, you know, expect to see a lot of Goldman people in the administration. Robert Rubin apparently is behind the scenes advising. He's a former chairman of Goldman Sachs, currently senior executive at Citibank, and you're going to see a lot of Goldman people. And Goldman is influential as ever, is my expectation. Now, Goldman, the current Secretary of the Treasury, is not a Goldman, certainly close to Goldman, but not a Goldman partner. But still, it's going to be a very Goldman Sachs-oriented administration, as was the last.
All right, let's talk about what does it mean that the Feds have lowered their key interest rate from 1% to essentially zero? We'll talk about that. What does that mean?
Right, they've lowered their federal funds rate from 1% to a target range of 0 to 0.25%. And what that means is that banks can basically borrow at 0% and proceed to lend to you on your credit card, you know, to 10-25%. So it gives them the ability to, another example is they can borrow money at 0% and buy treasury securities, you know, that earn some percentage in the long market, and basically print profits.
Profits?
Well, I've told this story several times before when I was on the board of Sallie Mae, and we had seven vice chairmen of big banks on our boards, and our speculation, this was in 93, 94, was Citibank had negative equity, it was essentially bankrupt. Would the Fed shut it down, or would Citibank be too big to fail? And what Alan Greenspan did, who was the Fed chairman at the time, was he allowed the banks to borrow at the Fed window and, kind of lowered the market, the interest rates in the short end, and the banks would borrow money in the short end and then buy treasury securities in the long end. And at the time, they were making 550 basis points. So they'd borrow at, say, 3% and lend at 8%. So extraordinary profits. And I had lunch during that period with a banker, at the time, Nations Bank, which is now part of the Bank of America, and they had $110 billion of treasury securities on their balance sheet. So they were making $6 billion a year just by borrowing cheap in the short end and lending to the U.S. taxpayers in the long end. And at the time, they had told people in the district that they weren't going to make loans to small business because it wasn't profitable. And I said to the guy, wait a minute, you're taking our deposits, and you're paying a little money for them, and then you're turning around and you're lending them back to us as taxpayers through the Treasury. And frankly, with the Internet, we don't need you to be in the middle of that. We don't need to pay you $6 billion to lend our money to ourselves. We can do that without you. And so what we've got is a machinery, Dennis, that, I mean, imagine if all the small farmers in this country could borrow as much money as they wanted at 0% and lend it back to the Treasury at several percentage points.
They wouldn't have to farm.
Exactly.
I mean, where do you go? By the way, I'm...
Well, but that's what's happening in the real economy. The real economy is being asked to subsidize everybody who's playing paper games.
Now, where do you, I don't know anything really about economics, but where do you go after zero to minus one?
Theoretically, occasionally, securities have traded below a 0% interest rate, but no, you really can't go there. I mean, you really can't go there. What you can do is continue, instead of just loaning people 0% money, you can create ways of borrowing the money back from them that guarantee them a profit, or an even greater profit. So there's, you know, there's more kind of stuff you can do. But what we're talking about is essentially removing the losses of a series of different players. So what you're watching, it goes back to the, my notion of the tapeworm economy, where certain players are protected no matter what goes wrong, and everybody else is not. And the cost of protecting the few means that the more, you know, ultimately we're all going to face the inflation that comes from the expansion of the money supply, which is used to protect some but not all.
All right, we have a couple of minutes left. Tell us what you were doing today.
Well, I just got back from a meeting in Hohenwald, Tennessee, which is where we had our financial permaculture conference, and the meeting was really to discuss whether or not Hohenwald should become a transition town. And, you know, I spend a lot of time, Dennis, working with people about what I can do, what one person can do, what a family can do. But ultimately, life gets a lot more fun in this environment when your whole community is engaged in saying, okay, now, what can we do? And there's a group got started in Ireland a few years ago called Transition Towns. It was a town in Ireland that was concerned about peak oil and said, you know, what could we do to reorganize ourselves to be much more self-sufficient? And one thing led to another. And there's a permaculturalist named Rob Hopkins who has popularized this notion of transition towns and has just published a book called Transition Town Handbook. And I think the thing that's interesting about the Transition Town Handbook is, or two things, is the network has caught on, and there's a Transition Town Wiki where lots of towns are starting to organize and sharing their information about what they're doing to rebuild local community in the face of what's going on. And so what came out of financial permaculture was the importance in Hohenwald, which is a lovely town south of Nashville in Lewis County in Tennessee, of engaging in a process that starts to engage everybody in the town who's interested in being part of this transition. And I think it's really something for those who are interested in working and sort of being in cahoots with their neighbors and in finding ways of organizing with people around them. The Transition Town Initiative really offers some very interesting resources because it allows us to act locally but to network globally.
So, to network nationally.
Globally,
I mean, yes.
I mean, for example, I'm in cahoots with, there's a, you know, I do a lot with New Zealand, and there's a wonderful transition town coordinator for New Zealand, James Samuels, who's on Waiheke Island, just fabulous guy. And, you know, so James and I are back and forth, so I'm, here I am sort of doing my little thing in Tennessee, but I'm networking with the transition town guys in New Zealand. And the important thing of that is if you look at what each town is learning to the extent that we can, you know, there's a lot that's going on in New Zealand that we could use here in Tennessee and vice versa. So you want to be networked both locally and globally, and transition towns is something that really resonates because we're all grappling with, you know, what's the process I use to start engaging with people locally that gives me energy and is a good use of my time.
All right. Go on. I'm sorry, go on.
No. Go. You go.
No, we're out of time. So
okay.
we're going to pick up this next week, Catherine Weston Fitz. We want to talk more about taking back the power of local community and rescuing local assets and not participating tacitly or actively in the bailout of Wall Street and the centralization of everything that we have.
Can I just point out one thing, Dennis?
Okay.
If interest rates are going to zero, you do not want to send your money to Wall Street at a 0% interest rate or 2 or 3% when you can figure out in a transition town concept of how to relieve somebody else of paying 20% on their credit card. That is an opportunity.
All right, solari.com if you want to communicate with Catherine Weston Fitz. And as always, an absolute enlightening pleasure. Thank you, Catherine. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're going to come back and talk about the impact of you can have by just taking off your shoes and throwing them. Stay tuned.
You're ready, Michael.
Rock with me.
little bit of rhythm make the world go round.
Whoa.
And you hear the sound.
Yeah.
A little bit of rhythm make the world go round.
Whoa.
And you hear the sound. A little bit of rhythm make the world go round.
Whoa.
And you hear the sound.
Yeah.
A little bit of rhythm make the world go round. Remember the time before, every day was a news of a holy war. When the people wasn't afraid to tell you what they want, everybody in the city always had a home. When a bomb wasn't going off every day, when the rain didn't have to mean a hurricane, when the government wasn't listening to your calls, when the border didn't have to mean a concrete wall. You're rock, and you hear the sound. A little bit of rhythm make the world go round. And you hear the sound. A little bit of rhythm.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, in a now widely publicized event, an Iraqi journalist this weekend took off his shoes and threw them at George W. Bush during a press conference in Baghdad. That was a surprise visit by Bush. The journalist, Muntada Al-Zeevi, has become an international hero in the Arab world. His recorded actions have been broadcast nonstop throughout the world and have made headlines from Gaza to Baghdad. Joining us to talk about the significance of the shoe toss is Raed Jarar, an Iraqi blogger and human rights activist working with the American Friends Service Committee. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm thinking that a lot of us feel that we wish that a few U.S. journalists would have taken their shoes off and thrown them at George Bush. But tell us, just very specifically, first of all, what is the significance of an action like that?
Well, I think the significance of throwing shoes at in any place in the world, it is a sign of disrespect and contempt. It shows how Iraqis are angry to see Bush. I think in Iraq, there are two very specific, most significances. Is that actually throwing shoes at is actually humiliating. It's equivalent to throwing maybe rotten or tomatoes on someone in Europe or the U.S. And the second significance is the timing. Bush went to Iraq to have this farewell visit and to try to portray the occupation and the entire policies that he was responsible of as a success. And I think these shoes in his face proved completely to everyone, to him, to his supporters, and to his enemies, that his policies were a complete failure, that despite all of the attempts to filter these visits, and make them make a couple of you know, propaganda like sound bites out of it. It failed, and an Iraqi man could not deal with his lies and arrogance. And then an Iraqi man spontaneously decided.
We're losing you. You know what? We're going to have to call you back because we have a very bad line. So if you could just hang up, we will call you back. In the meantime, let's go back to a little music and see if we can get a good line on that. Oh, you know what? Here's what we're going to do. Here is a little bit of sound from the actual event. This is the action of the shoes being thrown. Listen to this. Now, that was what happened, and you can imagine the beating this journalist took and the courage that it took to take on the President of the United States. Here is George W.'s response.
I didn't feel the least bit threatened by it. These journalists here were very apologetic. They were, you know, they were, you know, said this doesn't represent the Iraqi people, but that's what happens in free society.
Well, that's what happens in free society. So I think we got you back, Riad. So talk a little bit more. Bush says, you know, the press is playing right into this kind of violence by just putting it on the cover, putting it all over the world. But this was really quite the courageous statement to make, given the fact that he was he probably knew he was going to be totally beaten to a pulp.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very shocked to hear President Bush and other people in his administration speaking about this shoes in his face as a sign of success and a sign of free societies. Well, it's not. It's a sign of resistance to their plan, and it's a sign of how messed up Iraq is. This journalist who dared to stand in Bush's face and threw his shoes in his face, was beaten very heavily. Many reports talk about him being tortured for the last 2 days. Today, the official news website of his agency, Al-Baghdadiya, actually put a news saying that an Iraqi parliamentarian confirmed to them that Mr. Al-Zaidi's arm was broken in jail today. And many people are talking about the level of torture that he's being subjected to. So, I mean, I don't know how these things can be taken as the signs of democracy or progress. In fact, many Iraqi observers, including myself, think that if Bush was to listen to the voices of the Iraqi public, if Bush was to respect the democracy and the freedom of Iraqis and give them their country back, they wouldn't have had to throw a shoe in his face. If he was to listen to their demonstrations and to see their petitions and hear to what they were asking for the last 5 years, ending the occupation completely, they wouldn't have had to throw a shoe in his face. But he didn't. So, I mean, I just don't get how can they twist this too, you know? How can they try to make propaganda out of shoes thrown at the president's face?
Well, apparently the propaganda isn't working throughout the Arab world, because in Iraq and other places there were massive demonstrations. There was a major call in Iraq for his release. Thousands of people took to the streets, including many doctors, asking for the release and demanded that he not be any further tortured.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, let me just put things in context. Iraqis do not support throwing shoes at guests. I mean, they think this is inappropriate. And Iraqis don't think that journalists should be throwing shoes at people in press conferences. They think this is inappropriate. But Iraqis think that throwing shoes in the face of George W. Bush, the war criminal who destroyed Iraq and caused the death of 1 million Iraqis, the displacement of 5 million Iraqis, they don't think of this as disrespectful or unproportionate. They think about it as a very appropriate message. Now, I think it's very pathetic when I hear the same people who supported the war, supported dropping bombs on Iraq that killed civilians and destroyed the entire nation, that now they are all of the sudden, they are anti-violent, and they think that throwing a shoe that has not harmed anyone, that this is a violent action. But for God's sake, if you're that anti-violent, why would you support dropping bombs and putting tanks in neighborhoods and causing the death and destruction of an entire nation? You know, it's just this huge hypocrisy that is just showing to the world. I don't think the world will buy this. I think people do understand that it was a symbolic gesture and they support it.
And this is a journalist who had just been recently tortured and beaten and kidnapped and was really expressing the experiences of frustration that almost cost him his life.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, now, let me put things, make two points. The first one is that just a few weeks ago, around 1 million Iraqis demonstrated in the streets of Baghdad, and then they burned a Bush effigy and they hit it with shoes. So this is not like a one-man idea or a one-man's, you know, feelings against the Bush and the Bush administration and their policies. It is a very widespread feeling that the majority of Iraqis feel. And many people think that these shoes in the face of Bush were actually a very symbolic evaluation for the entire Bush policy in Iraq, the entire ease of occupation and destruction. Now, on the other hand, the other point that I want to make is that people are very much worried about his personal safety. Because, as I said, the news about his arm being broken, the news about the government trying to put him in jail for long years, and him being put under torture now, these are very worrisome news. And I think it is important for us in these upcoming few days, as people who live outside the U.S., to try to pressure the Bush administration and al-Maliki's government, the Bush allies in Iraq, to stop abusing and torturing and imprisoning Mr. al-Zaidi. There are a couple of campaigns out there that are trying to put pressure on the Iraqi government to ask for his immediate release or at least to send him to a court. And these campaigns are domestic in Iraq, or some of them are international in Europe and in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Well, you know, I'm wondering if there are any high-level officials either in the outgoing Bush administration or the incoming Obama administration that are speaking up publicly about what they know to be torture in progress. Anybody who watched that press conference knew that once they took this journalist down, he was being hurt. And it's very clear, as you say, from reports all over the world, that he has been tortured. You say his arm was broken in jail today. You would think that the Democratic administration of the United States, George Bush is very open. He wasn't afraid at all. He said that it didn't, you know, didn't really affect him. This is free speech. This is the way democracy works. Well, where is there anger, and has anybody made a statement from the administration saying, don't torture this journalist, even though he threw the shoes at us?
Well, not until now. And we shouldn't forget, Dennis, that Mr. al-Zaidi is one out of tens of thousands of Iraqi prisoners. I mean, thank God that we know his name, and now we can follow his case within the Iraqi prisons. But there are other tens of thousands of Iraqi prisoners under the U.S. and Iraqi custody who have been, some of them have been imprisoned for years now with no charges, with no access to lawyers, and with no due process. So many of them were tortured, and we don't know about them. We don't know about their names. Many people think that Mr. al-Zaidi's case will highlight this very dangerous issue that has been happening in Iraq. We have a lot of information in the U.S. about what has been happening in Guantanamo for the few hundreds of inmates of Guantanamo that have been tortured and kept without access to lawyers and without being charged. There are tens of thousands of Iraqis who live in the same conditions, if not worse, than the conditions of Guantanamo, and Mr. al-Zaidi is joining them now. So there must be something that should happen. As you mentioned earlier, hundreds of lawyers are volunteering to represent him, and many people are asking to end this torture campaign. Now, we are going through this change in the U.S. I hope that someone from the upcoming administration speaks out and says people should not be tortured, whether they were in Guantanamo, or whether it was Mr. Zaidi, or whether they were the other tens of thousands of Iraqis who are being held with no charges in U.S. and Iraqi prisons. Someone must do something about these people.
Is it commonly accepted on the ground in Iraq that this wide-ranging program of torture that you refer to, probably in large degree supervised by private mercenaries, is the result of U.S. policy?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's either the result of U.S. policy or that the U.S. is giving their Iraqi allies the blind eye. People know and realize exactly what has been happening in U.S. jails, whether it's Abu Ghraib or other jails, systematic and continuous torture and abuse of prisoners. And they know that the U.S. gives the Maliki government the blind eye. We shouldn't forget, for example, the dungeons, the underground prisons that were under the Ministry of Interior, that many Iraqis were tortured and killed in them. And they were just under the eyes of the U.S. Army and CIA. The U.S. Government has a full floor in the Ministry of Interior. Every day they went by this prison and saw or heard Iraqis being tortured and killed. So they know that this is happening with the help and support and cover and justification of the U.S. government. And this is another important issue to ask for the upcoming administration. Is Obama and other people in his administration going to continue giving this political cover and justification for their allies in Iraq and elsewhere in the region to torture and imprison their citizens with no due process? Or is Obama going to change its policy to another one?
We only have a couple of minutes left, but this treatment of this journalist, you talked about many thousands being in prison. Is there a policy that journalists who take on the U.S.-supported government, some would say a puppet government, are brutalized, are kidnapped, are tortured?
Well, yeah, the lucky ones are kidnapped and tortured. The unlucky ones are just assassinated in the streets or thrown outside the country. Iraq had huge numbers of journalists who were killed and assassinated in the last few years, and many journalists feel unsafe to criticize the government. Al-Baghdadiya channel and Mr. Al-Zaidi were actually among very few TV stations and media stations in Iraq who still dare to criticize the Bush administration and criticize al-Maliki's government and criticize the occupation. And this is happening now. In addition to torturing and imprisoning Mr. Al-Zaidi, the Iraqi authorities are trying to completely destroy his TV channel. Many people are saying that they will ban them from working in Iraq and they will put very heavy punishments against them. So you can see which level of freedom of expression and speech we are living in under this foreign occupation, and how when Iraqis hear Bush and Rice speak about free societies and democracies, they laugh at them. They think these people in the administration live in a different universe, because in the universe that Iraqis live in, there is no such a thing as freedom of expression or freedom of press. There is such a thing as a country being occupied by foreigners, and people can't get out of their door. They can't say a word. They can't live their life. They can't go on with their life. So there is a huge gap between the description that the Bush administration has been giving us and the Iraqi understanding of their life. It's all hope that the next upcoming administration will shift gears and understand that things on the ground are very much different than the propaganda that the Bush administration has been giving. And that the next administration, the Obama administration, will follow the announced timetable, the 16-month timetable, that Obama has promised the U.S. public over and over that he will end the war within 16 months. Let's hope that Obama will actually bring all the troops home, completely in 16 months without leaving any permanent bases in Iraq or mercenaries. And within these 16 months where the U.S. occupation continues, that the next administration will make sure that no torture and no abuse will take place.
All right. We have been speaking with Raad Jarar. Raad Jarar is an Iraqi blogger, human rights activist, works with the American Friends Service Committee. And is there a way that people can follow your work?
Yeah, I hope that your readers, your viewers, will have a time to check my blog. It's Raed, my name Raed, Raed in the middle .blogspot.com. There is a petition there asking for the immediate release of Mr. Al Zaidi, and it was signed by a few hundred people today and yesterday. So I hope your viewers will be among the signers of this petition. I will print it out and take it to the Iraqi embassy by the end of the week.
All right, well, I want to thank you very much for the very important information.
Now we're going to go to Los Angeles to talk to Trayvon Williams, the son of Stanley Tookie Williams, about the state-sanctioned murder of his father at San Quentin on the third anniversary. Trey Williams, December 13th was the third anniversary of your father being murdered by the state of California. What were your thoughts on the subject?
Well, my thoughts are still the same, man. Still don't understand why they did it. Still think the death penalty is barbaric, is vindictive, and things of that nature. But basically, on this anniversary, it was a little different, man. And I say that because this 13th, December 13th, which was Saturday that just passed, man, I spent my day not just reflecting on my father's, but doing a visual for one of the guys that work on my staff with my outreach, man. His wife was murdered. And his two daughters were shot, so we were having a vigil for her over there where she got killed, that murdered, that shall I say. So my thoughts kind of, you know, went both ways, man. For one minute, I was reflecting on my father, thinking of the good things that him and I talked about and did. But at the same time, I'm still thinking, seeing this man with his wife gone, saying, okay, well, how does the death penalty deter these criminal acts that's still being executed out here on these streets? So it was a two-way street for me on that day, man. It was a happy but sad day, man.
before we get into the organization that you are heading, what is the legacy of your father, Stanley Tookie Williams?
Well, the legacy, as far as where I'm concerned, is redemption. I mean, there's no better way to put it. Art said it's just simply one word, and that's redemption. He redeemed himself, and his whole mission was to let those youth, those in trouble, those thinking about getting in trouble, that, hey, you can redeem yourself too, which is to convert yourself into something of value, to change something better.
How have you been following through on this legacy? I know that you have an organization. Can you talk about some of the work that you are involved in?
Yes, gladly. Well, one way I have did it is just continuing this legacy by dealing with the youth, dealing with those that's headed towards the wrong direction, headed towards that road, that's been down that road or even thinking about it. Just trying to steer some of these dudes away from the daily temptation that they face with, that they're faced with on the streets of L.A., because we're all faced with it, man. All these youth are one step away from getting involved with that madness. So that's what I'm doing, and that's how I'm continuing it through my organization, One Way Outreach, OneWayOutreach.com. You can check me out on the Internet and see what we're doing. Just dealing with the youth, man, just dealing with the youth and trying to show them that it's a better way, mainly through education, but also through in-depth giving them in-depth understanding of the streets. What I mean by that, I kind of feel that the best way to keep these dudes out the streets is to get those that's in the streets to tell them don't do it. Like my father said, don't follow my footsteps. That's what I do. I go around and I get some of the most hardcore guys that change their life around and redeem themselves to tell the youth, look, you don't want to follow my footsteps. So that's how we're continuing this legacy.
Well, for those that don't know, do you have a past history in the streets?
Of course, we all do. Coming up in L.A., it's kind of hard not to. You know, I how can I not? You know, my father was a Crip. My mother was one of the first Criplets. So I was kind of like born into it in a sense. But look at me now.
Is it your father's case that gave you the strength, or what is it that gave you the strength to do what it is you're doing now and trying to be constructive in the community?
Well, he definitely had a part of it, and he definitely was a big part of it, shall I say. But first, I got to first give glory to the Most High God and the Most High God in Christ. But my father, yes, it wasn't just his case. It was him being a father, period. Just, you know, just talking to him and him putting, you know, showing me that other side of giving me things to think about, kind of saying, hey, check this out. What do you think about this? But he definitely was a stronghold in it, seeing what they was doing to him, seeing what was happening to the guys I was on the streets with, as far as some going to jail, some being maimed, paralyzed, snitching, all kind of things. You know, just seeing the streets for what it really was, which is nothing.
I know that you were a few seasons ago on the BET show American Gangster, where you basically said that your father was not an American gangster. Can you expand a little bit on what you said on the TV show?
Well, you know, I was kind of, that was a while back, but basically what I was getting at on that American Gangster part was that, you know, what George Bush and them did as American Gangster, this economic bailout and all these things we're going through now is American Gangster. The CIA, that's American Gangster. COINTELPRO, that's American Gangster. Meaning my father was, what my father did or what he was involved with is minute to what these real American gangsters are doing. So, you know, we all know what's going on in America. So that's basically what I meant as far as, you know, to call my father American Gangster. If he was American Gangster, he had to be a tiny American Gangster, because we got some big OG American Gangsters out there, if you know what I mean.
No doubt. What's the fondest memory of your father that you can remember that you would care to share with the listening audience? How do you remember Stanley Tookie Williams as his son?
Well, you know, my basically some of the memories I'm going to keep to myself just for personal reasons. You know, that's all I have to hold on to in my meditation.
I understand.
But basically, you being my boy, man, basically it's just his strength, his fortitude, his constitution. Man, this was a strong guy, man. What people don't know is this man was sincere. This man was real sincere, and he was dedicated to the cause from day one. So basically, I would just have to say his constitution and his strength.
No,
as far as standing strong, never getting rattled throughout the whole ordeal, he still remained calm. You know, he was more calm than I was on that last 30 minutes before they did what they did. Just to hear his voice, his calmness, just let me know that everything was all right. So what that thing, that right there let me know that, you know, us being Williams, we can face anything.
You talked to him?
Strong, yes.
You talked to him the last 30 minutes before they assassinated him?
Yes, sir.
And yes, sir. If it wasn't too personal, can you share what it is that you can share with us about what did he say in those last 30 minutes if it wasn't too personal?
Well, basically, you know, man, I think we talked about that before. Basically, we expressed our love for one another, that I'm definitely going to continue his legacy. He passed me the torch, told me he was proud of me, and we kind of said the Lord's Prayer, and we went through our giving each other kudos, as we always would do in one way or the other, sarcastically or not. Basically, that was it, man. No crying.
No doubt.
Definitely no crying and no boo-hooing, shall I say. It might have been tears falling out of my eyes. I don't know about his because I wasn't there, but it definitely wasn't any crying or, you know, going crazy boo-hooing.
Right. If people want to help you in your quest to further your father's legacy, to strengthen your father's legacy, and to get involved with some of the work that you're doing in the Los Angeles area, how could they get in contact with you online, as well as how can they get in? Is there any other way they can get in contact with you?
Well, man, I definitely appreciate you for that. First of all, the telephone number is 323-755-4702. The email address is OOI, that's One Way Outreach, Inc. That's OOI, that's what it's short for, OOI Outreach at Yahoo.com. That's OOI Outreach at Yahoo.com. Or you can check out the website. It's up and coming. That's www.oneway1outreach.com.
One of your guys called me right before we did this interview. He said that there's a P.O. Box.
Yes, P.O. Box. Thank you, man. P.O. Box 90859. Los Angeles, California, 9009. P.O. Box 90859, Los Angeles, California, 90009. Thank you, brother, for even mentioning that, man. I appreciate you.
No doubt. Thanks, Trey, for coming on with us again, man. And, you know, let us know whatever it is that we could do to aid you in your quest to work in your father's legacy, man.
Man, I appreciate you. Just keep doing what you're doing. As long as you keep putting it out there and promulgating it, man, his spirit lives on. And I thank you for that, brother. Like I said, whenever you need me, we ready down here in L.A. Despite this little setback we had with my boy losing his wife and two daughters being shot, we still going to continue it, man. And that's what we got to do. The Bible says, he that told need is not a physician, but he that's sick. And that's what I'm here to do, to go to the sick. So wherever the sick is at, if you need us, if you want to have us, if you want us to speak, we there, we ready.
No doubt. And can you offer your condolences to the brother dealing with his family and the losses in his family?
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that, man.
All right, talk to you soon, Trey.
All right, brother. Be safe out there, man, and keep on doing what you're doing.
All right, you too, bro.
Peace.
Later. You were just listening to the voice of Trayvon Williams, the son of Stanley Tookie Williams, who was reflecting on the legacy of his father on the third anniversary after he was murdered by the state of California at San Quentin. I am the Minister of Information, JR, signing off for www.blockreportradio.com.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music this week by Michael Fronti and Spearhead. A little bit of rhythm, and see you in the light. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.